Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. WBAI, where this show originates, is fundraising this week, so my show is an expanded edition, larded with appeals for money. I've extracted two interviews from that show, uncharacteristically both documentary film-related, supplemented and sutured with some fresh material to make this show for KPFA and the web audience. The first interview is with Sandy Chaffee, director of a very fine documentary about oil production in Nigeria and the resistance to its ravages called Sweet Crude. And the second is with Christian Parenti, a frequent guest in this show, about an equally fine documentary he's a prominent actor in called Fixer, The Taking of Ajmal Nashbandi. It's about a man who assisted Christian in his 5 reporting visits to Afghanistan as translator, guide, and fellow journalist, who was kidnapped and beheaded by the Taliban. Before that, some words in the economic news. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve completed its regular policy-setting meeting, an event that happens every 6 weeks or so. The communique they issued after this one contained few surprises. They see the economy as leveling out and the financial markets in an improving trend, but prosperity is anything but around the corner. More precisely, they expect economic activity to remain weak for a time, in their phrase, and anticipate that they will continue to engineer a regime of exceptionally low, in their phrase, interest rates. They see the risks of inflation as very low, too, unlike a lot of Wall Street hawks who are convinced, very wrongly in my view, that all this government largesse will stoke inflationary fires. The wrongness of that was brought home by Friday's report in Consumer Price Index for July, which showed prices outside energy to be almost flat. The Fed will continue to buy up mortgage bonds. They're now the major funder of mortgage lending in the U.S. economy through such purchases, but they will phase out their purchases of U.S. Treasury bonds by October. That's a month later than originally expected, but it's still the beginning of something like the end of their extraordinary interventions in the markets that have gone on for 2 years now. As regular listeners know, my view of the state of the U.S. economy is pretty similar to the Fed's. Economist Ed McKelvey of Goldman Sachs, regular listeners also know that I've been pretty critical of Goldman's tightness with the U.S. government and their ability to use that relationship to make lots and lots of money, but their economists are first-rate and always worth listening to. McKelvey put it nicely the other day when he said that while the economy is stabilizing, it remains vertically challenged. Or, it stopped falling, but shows no signs yet of getting up. The once indefatigable American consumer, for example, is still looking pretty tired now. On Thursday, we learned that retail sales, excluding autos, fell for the 5th straight month in July. The Cash for Clunkers program, that horrendous boondoggle, did stimulate some car sales, but most other categories were down. Most analysts, including me, had been expecting no change or even a slight increase. The rate of decline in retail spending has slowed markedly from last year's record-breaking collapse, but we're not seeing anything like a recovery yet. Whenever I say things like that, I'm caught in a dilemma. Consumer spending is at the heart of our economic setup, but in a rational world, the economy wouldn't be so dependent on a frenzied pace of consumption. So on one hand, I'm hoping for a recovery, but on the other, I'm hoping for a long-term transformation. I don't know how to resolve that contradiction. If you've got any ideas, please let me know. In other news, we learned that bankruptcy filings by individuals rose by over 15% in the second quarter compared to the first, and by businesses, almost 12%. Personal bankruptcies are in a strong uptrend again. Filings soared in the run-up to the tightening of the bankruptcy code in 2006 as people rushed to beat the deadline, and then fell back sharply. But they started rising again almost immediately. Almost 5 out of every 1,000 people filed for bankruptcy in the second quarter of 2009. That's well below the peak of almost 9 per thousand in the last quarter of 2005 in a last-minute filing rush, but it's above the level we saw at any time before 1997. The rise in bankruptcies, which, aside from being a major trauma for the people involved, can also be seen as a symptom of general debt distress and economic strain, that rise over the last few decades is an amazing thing. In 1950, only about 2 people in 10,000, not 2 people per 1,000, but 2 in 10,000, filed for bankruptcy. That rose some as the years went on, but we still didn't see 1 per 1,000 until 1973. By 1990, it was almost 3 per 1,000. It broke 5 per 1,000 in 1997, and then fell back some as the economy boomed. It rose again starting after the 2000 stock market bust and 2001 recession, peaking in 2005, just before the barbaric bankruptcy reform took effect. And now it's spiking again. Business bankruptcies, which are largely unaffected by the change in the law, are on track to come in at the highest level since the mid-1980s and early 1990s. Early in the week, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that labor productivity, output per work hour, rose at a 6.4% annual rate in the second quarter of this year, an extremely strong performance. Unit labor costs, how much employers have to pay workers per unit of output, fell by an also extraordinary 5.8%. To use the old Marxist language, these figures show that employers are coping with the recession by increasing the rate of exploitation, laying off workers, and squeezing the remaining ones harder than ever. Over the long term, productivity can only grow if firms invest in equipment, which they're not doing right now. But in the short term, they can speed up the line and make one person do the job of two. And surviving workers won't complain because they're scared of losing their own jobs. The level of fear was well measured in a recent Gallup poll, which found 31% of workers worried about being laid off, twice the 2008 level in this yearly poll, and easily the highest share since they started asking the question in 1997. Actually, this isn't that much of a surprise. What is a surprise in the history of responses to these questions is that even in relatively good times, 15 to 20% of workers are scared of losing their jobs. That state of fear no doubt brings a smile to the lips of employers, but it's a hell of a way to run a society. And finally, though the U.S. economy is likely to show some positive growth numbers by year-end, in an amazing development, it's looking like the economies of Europe are doing even better. France and Germany are reporting modest growth for the second quarter, while we're still contracting. This is a remarkable turnabout from the days when Americans routinely mocked the sluggishness of Europe and celebrated the dynamism of the USA. Maybe, as a friend of mine pointed out, having a financial system that's regulated to minimize bubbles and a fiscal system that provides generous support to people out of work really does have some economic benefits, aside from being more humane. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Nigerian oil.
Of all of the people that I used to know, both never adjusted to the great big world. I'd see them lurking in bookstores, working for the public radio. Yeah, the babies around, stack on their back, moving chair for itself. Money doesn't matter.
That was some of It's Money That Matters by Randy Newman with Mark Knopfler on guitar. And now an interview with Sandy Chaffee, director of the movie Sweet Crude. For more on the movie, see sweetcrudemovie.com. To the original introduction. We're now joined in the studio by Sandy Chaffee, who directed a very fine movie, which I watched this afternoon, called Sweet Crude, about the production of oil in Nigeria, and the horrors that has produced and the resistance to those horrors. First of all, tell us a little bit how you came to make this movie.
Thanks very much, by the way, for calling it a fine film. I appreciate it.
Oh, I mean that. And I'm Thank not you. A big cinephile, so I thought it was very fine work.
It was a little bit of an unusual way to enter into a project like this. I was actually hired to document the efforts of an American nonprofit organization that went to the Niger Delta in 2005 to help build a library in a village there that had very little resources of any kind. And that said, the region is producing billions of dollars of oil, and so there's obviously a large disconnection between the resources coming out of the ground and the quality of life for the people who live in the area. While I was there, it became very clear to me that the Niger Delta was about to go through a major change and that the media was barely paying attention. In fact, most American media outlets had not covered the Niger Delta since 1995 when Ken Saro-Wiwa, who some of your listeners I'm sure would remember.
I'm sure people are very familiar with that name, yeah.
Who was killed along with eight other activists, Ogoni activists, who were fighting against Shell Oil in the 1990s. They were killed in 95. But between 95 and 2005, there was very, very little media attention at all, even though the conditions of life there had continued to deteriorate, but Nigeria's oil output continued to increase. So it was clear to me that I had to go back and do a much deeper story about the young organizers and students who were turning from nonviolent resistance to guns. And that group now is known as MEND, or the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta.
Let's step back a bit. When did oil production begin in Nigeria?
1958. It was just as the British were leaving. It was a British colony. And much like in Iraq, the borders of Nigeria were relatively arbitrarily drawn by the British, and that created many of the problems that exist today because parts of the country were put into one country that made no organic sense to the people who live there.
And the production of oil is an extremely dirty thing, right? So tell us about the trail of environmental destruction the production of oil has left behind.
Sure. And it's ironic because part of the reason the movie's titled Sweet Crude is that the oil in Nigeria is particularly low in sulfur, which makes it a lot more valuable to oil producers because what you have to do to it to get it ready for market is next to nothing. So the oil itself is cleaner, but pulling it out of the ground, extracting it, is dirty for many reasons. The basic ones are these. The amount of dredging alone, and you're talking about a river marsh area where you have sweet water and salt water, sweet water, of course, meaning water without salt in it, and you have fish populations that are used to living in the right kind of water. And when you dredge the water, you create an environment where the mangroves die, which means that all kinds of critters that live in the mangroves die. Then all the critters that used to eat those critters die. Then you've got salt and sweet water mixed. Then you have the level of oil spillage, which is unprecedented anywhere on the planet. In fact, it's the equivalent of one Exxon Valdez per year since 1958, 70% of which has never been cleaned up.
And there are moving scenes of the film where people testify to what it used to be like or the creatures that they used to remember. They see pictures of, even in publications or movies coming from the United States, that
yes.
They have no firsthand experience of. That their whole way of life has been ruined by the production of oil. And yet, despite all the money that this oil has generated, they have absolutely nothing to show for it, right?
That's right. And that's, of course, complicated. And one of the easy excuses that the oil companies use is that the Nigerian dictators over the years have been thieves and stolen the money.
Which is true enough.
And it's true. So the problem in fighting that argument is that it's true, but they've been a den of thieves because the military dictators have allowed the oil companies to behave the way they have because they have a tacit agreement. If I let you pull the oil out of the ground in the most abusive, environmentally destructive way we know, and if I let you produce that oil with virtually no international standards, and there's no auditing about how much oil is coming out of the ground, and if you pay me 60 cents on the dollar of what you report, well, heck, I'll send you security and troops that'll keep those people from ever bothering you. And I'll let you treat the Niger Delta as though there aren't even humans who live there.
I always wonder when I see things about it or read about this, could the production of oil be done more cleanly? Does it have to be this dirty?
It absolutely can be done more cleanly. And one of the most important things that could be done immediately is to stop gas flaring. Gas flaring is the process by which you, when you drill for oil, there's a part of the planet you have to go through that has natural gas. If you don't harness that gas, you have to burn it off. But when you burn it off...
Wouldn't it be a good idea to capture the gas and use it?
Absolutely, except that it costs a heck of a lot of money to do, and the only places where they started doing it originally are places where they were forced to do it. Well, right now, the Niger Delta in Nigeria is flaring more gas than anywhere left on the planet Earth. In fact, you can see it from outer space. And it's so egregious because it produces so much acid rain.
I was stunned. It damages roofs. Just the rainfall is harmful, right?
That's correct. In fact, for me, so striking that I would see a brand new railing in November of 2005. I returned in August of 2006, and I'd see that railing pitted out in the shape of raindrops already in those 8 months. And, metal just crippled, rusted, and cracked because of the quality of the acid rain.
Now, people in this area, and it's what the Niger Delta we're talking
yes.
about, the people in this area at least still try and used to quite successfully draw livelihood from the soil and the water, right? And what
yes.
has happened now to their livelihoods?
Well, to give a little bit of context, this is 20 million people who live in the most populous country in Africa, a country that now is 150 million people. And what we're calling the Niger Delta, that's all of the riverine communities in the southern part of the country, what's often referred to as the Gulf of Guinea, some of the largest amounts of untapped oil left on the planet. And those communities, 20 million people, used to be fully self-sustaining as fishing communities. The amount of shellfish there, again, in another irony, that's why there's so much oil there. Those decomposed shellfish become the oil over millions and millions of years.
That explains the logo of the oil company, too, I suppose.
Yes, as a matter of fact, yeah. I mean, I'm dumb enough, but I didn't know that until I worked on this film. You know, I just learned it.
So how does people get by living in this toxic muck?
Well, what academics call places like the Niger Delta are informal economies. I mean, essentially, if you're a young person there, regardless of your level of education, there is almost no employment prospect for you. And if you live in a riverine community, you're forced to go to a city in order to do anything that would create food for your family. So it's one of the many reasons that people consider Nigeria such a corrupt nation. You have an awful lot of people who are, I would say, maybe entrepreneurial on some level. I mean, if I lived on the streets of New York and had no way to make a living but to sort of come up with a way to get stuff from one guy and sell it to another guy, maybe that's what I'd do for a living.
Yeah, that's what the development economists like to call it. Selling pencils on the street is a form of entrepreneurship.
Exactly.
Now, obviously, the people of the region are not taking this lying down. So the name I hadn't heard before, Isaac Adakaboro. Tell us about him.
Isaac Adakaboro, in the Niger Delta, a lot of the communities are broken down by ethnic groups. And Ken Sarawiwa was an Ogoni leader. Isaac Adakaboro is an Ija leader. And he was what is considered now to have been the early hero of the Niger Delta because he developed what was called the 12-day revolution. After he was trying, even back then, and we're talking about in the 60s, to be reasonable with the federal government of Nigeria about the control of the oil, he realized it was a brick wall, and from his perspective, the only hope was a full-on secession and revolution, and he was successful in managing to break away from the Federal Republic for 12 days, and then they captured him and actually forced him. They gave him an option. They would either hang him or force him to fight with the Nigerian government in the Biafran War, and he died in that war.
You mentioned the government several times. Has it been a succession of military governments that have ruled the country?
Almost exclusively, with the exception of the recent years. Believe it or not, the government now is supposed to be a democratically elected government. By the way, Hillary Clinton was there yesterday. Meeting with the minister of the country, and we can get to that. But it's supposed to be a country with which we have full diplomatic relations. They had a presidential election in 2007, albeit one of the most fraudulent in the country's history, widely considered by election monitors.
And as somebody says in your film, that's saying a lot by Nigerian historical standards, right?
Yes, it's Professor Michael Watts from Berkeley, and he said, yeah, that's really saying something. So it is now, but what you realize when you're there is that the true power in the country still completely lies with the Nigerian military, which is called the JTF, or Joint Task Force. The military dictators had such a succession and such a power structure that the generals really are still in charge of the country.
Is there some sort of like parasitic oil elite? Like there seems to be a structure in many oil-producing countries that there's this narrow stratum of a rich elite that sucks off all the money and everybody else is left in poverty and pollution. Is that the social structure of Nigeria as
it's
well?
It's pretty much true. Some people call that a kleptocracy, petroleum paradox. I think that what's a little different in Nigeria, and in this I think there's some hope, I think that some of the young people who are not taking this lying down, yes, on the one hand, they have become militants, and some of those militants have engaged in criminal activities. But when you really look at what's happening, their perspective is, hey, this oil was on my ethnic ground, my ancestors' land. I had rights to it. And what I'm actually doing now is I'm forming my own company, and I'm selling this oil. And in some cases, those people could run small oil companies of their own. So it's not just that there's an oil elite. There's actually some money finally getting to the villagers. But ironically, it's getting to them only because of the activities of the insurgents, not because of the very government that was supposed to be collecting taxes and building hospitals and schools.
Speaking of Sadi Chofi, who's the director of a very fine documentary, which is screening in New York this week at the IFC, or starting Friday at the IFC Center on 6th Avenue at West 3rd Street, starting tomorrow afternoon at 3:30. And making the festival circuit, right?
Yes, we are, yes.
Let's fast forward to Ken Sarawiwa. He certainly burst into international fame, but what produced him? What kind of movement did he lead or what that
Ken
created
Sarawiwa
him?
Ken Sarawiwa famously led what was called MOSOP, or the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People. And at the time, so we're talking about the late 80s, late 1980s and early 1990s, Shell Oil, which is the largest oil company in the Niger Delta, was being accused of intentionally supporting the Nigerian government to fight against its own people, because realized that in a pretty direct and clear example of sort of a taxation without representation in reverse, the people of the Delta have all the resources that support the entire country. 90% of the country's entire wealth comes from that area. But those people don't even have running water or electricity. So Ken Sarawiwa was a nonviolent activist who was leading this amazing movement. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who were, I mean, every possible kind of action you can imagine, and getting world sympathy. And to many people around the world, he was considered the Nelson Mandela of Nigeria. He put the Nigerian problem on the map. He made it clear that as South African was becoming a country that we now know as a democratically elected country, that Nigeria needed to do the same on the West Coast. And Nigeria has always been considered a linchpin of stability to the continent. Ken Sarawiwa was, and by the way, his family sued the Shell Oil Company, and that case was finally heard in New York City this year. It took all these years. And if you're interested in this topic, there's a great website, Wiwa v. Shell. The Wiwa family settled, and some people are angry about that because they feel that they wanted more documents to come out. I think reasonable people on all sides have different opinions about this. But Ken Sarawiwa at the time was accused of murder because the Nigerian government's strategy of how to ruin him with his own people was to try to not just kill him, but discredit him first. And I think that's an important thing to know when you look at what's happening now. When you look at what's happening now with the media's coverage of MEND and with the way that the story of the Niger Delta is getting told, it's a very similar template that the attempt is to ruin the legitimacy of the political claims of the people asking for the world community to help them and impugn their character as much as simply assassinate them.
Yeah, I want to talk about that because there's a lot of the people you interview in the film, a lot of the young Nigerians are just very impressive, thoughtful, eloquent people. I was very moved and impressed by them. And then you run some footage from ABC and CNN where they're portrayed as a terrorist movement, and they're portrayed in the most violent and cartoonish manner. I was really stunned by that contrast. But tell us about MEND. Where did they come from, and what are their aims?
Well, the young men of MEND are a collection of all kinds of parts of the Niger Delta, and I think part of what is very important is that they're more of a pan-Delta movement.
It's the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta?
Correct. Yeah, yeah. Now, they come from lots of walks of life. One walk of life is student leadership, young organizers who, after Ken Sarawiwa, worked for something that was called the Kayama Declaration. When you read the Kayama Declaration, it literally reads like the Declaration of Independence. It is unbelievably well done. And there's a fairly famous man. His name is Aronto Douglas. He was one of Ken Sarawiwa's attorneys, and he was one of the leaders of that movement, and that was late 1990s. These were still young people who believed that the world would come to their defense. They're very much people who believe the UN, the US, the EU couldn't possibly allow the continuation of an abusive government firing upon their own innocent civilians just to take oil out of the ground. And I sort of watch their struggle, and I look at what I think is their incredulity, that they have never been the ones that people come for. And they went into deeper and deeper levels of protest right up through, in 2002, 2003, groups of women that paddled wooden canoes up to oil platforms, climbed on them, and commandeered them from oil workers. There's this amazing story about these oil security workers who were trained to secure these oil barges against all enemies except women who would climb up and do nothing more than say, we demand jobs, we demand a clean environment. After all of that, what I really believe that I saw as a documentary filmmaker is the people saying, we did everything you can possibly do that is reasonable, and no one came. But the minute we kidnapped an American oil worker, CNN, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, they all showed up. And I think from their perspective, they think they have nothing left that they can do but put on a mask, grab an AK-47, and say we're done.
And then Bush administration and ABC News and the like did their best to subordinate these folks or assimilate them to the whole master narrative of terrorism, right? They're a branch of al-Qaeda, practically.
Which is strange for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that in Nigeria, one of the other concerns is that there is tension between the Muslim North and the Christian South. But these guys are actually from the Christian South. So if anyone were paying attention to the actual facts, which always get in the way of a good incendiary news
facts
story.
Facts are stupid things, as Ronald Reagan said.
That's right. So that doesn't make sense. But as much as the Bush administration is to blame for that, I want to say that I am very concerned about the transcript I read of Hillary Clinton's visit yesterday. I mean, here a lot of people have been very hopeful that this administration's approach toward the Niger Delta would be to be very clear to the Nigerian government that firing upon your own civilians is unacceptable, and if you're going to continue to be the recipient of full American support and aid, we had hoped that there could be at least a coded message in there that there is the necessity of a political, not military solution. unfortunately, that's not exactly what she said. So we at Sweet Crude are going to hope that what Madam Secretary really meant to say was that bombing people indiscriminately in the Niger Delta in the pretend guise that you're going after militants is unacceptable.
I'd be very surprised if that happens, I've got to say. Let's try to conclude this on a somewhat hopeful note, because the stories of resistance much of your film are about, yes, are very inspiring. And people who tried every nonviolent means and have finally given, or at least some of them have just given up hope that nonviolence is going to get them anywhere. What's the mix of strategies now? What's the mix of nonviolence versus some kind of armed resistance?
I think it very much hangs in the balance, and I think part of the reason I was motivated to make the film is to ask people in the United States and Europe what role we play in making a nonviolent movement possible. If we don't witness it, isn't it the case that we're saying to people that one of the very strategies, which is to make obvious what's wrong with your enemy, if we don't witness what they're asking us to witness, what do we give them as an option? So to me, part of what we can do now is to say we understand that one of the most pressing concerns on the African continent is what is a preventable tragedy. To me, the other issue is how many people do we expect to die before we consider this a problem? Do we require this to be as bad as Rwanda became or Darfur became? 10 years from now, it can be that bad. We could have millions of people die and tens of millions of refugees.
The body count already has been quite high.
It's very high, and it is more than possible for this place to see a political solution that is much more nonviolent than violent.
And the amount of oil that Nigeria produces and can produce, there's plenty of money to go around, right?
That's correct.
If the usual suspects were not so intent on claiming it all for themselves.
That's right. And Nigeria, like many other places, but it is the perfect place to learn the alchemy between guns and oil, and the question that's there in the template of whether or not we succeed with diplomacy in the Niger Delta could be spread all over the world.
And finally, I noticed that in the film you reflect on your role as a documentary filmmaker and just how objective or involved you're going to be. You seem now to have given up on the objectivity.
Absolutely. And I think my responsibility to the audience was to be candid about the lens through which I'm showing them the film. Because to me, it's almost impossible to imagine that you'd be in a place like that and maintain neutrality. In fact, it's not physically possible. If you're going to travel on the waterways, you have to be taken care of by someone. So you're either being taken care of by an oil company, the Nigerian government, or the militants. You're not a neutral party. So I think, to be honest with an audience member, what lens you have gives them a fair fight about understanding your perspective.
Well, I've got to say, it's a very fine work, and best of luck with it.
Thank
and
you.
You have the website, sweetcrude.org.
Sweet Crude Movie.
Sweetcrudemovie.com.
Sweetcrudemovie.com. You can get there through any of the dots.
Okay.
Yeah, sweetcrudemovie.com.
All right, and best of luck with it. Thanks for joining us,
Sandy
Chofi.
You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk Afghanistan with Christian Parenti. Sum up defunct during the old OJ's tune For the Love of Money. And now an interview with Christian Parenti. HBO will air the documentary we talk about in this interview, Fixer, starting on Monday, August 18th at 9 p.m. in the East and at midnight, August 18th into the 19th in the West. It will be repeated several times after that until late September. Now to the original intro. We're joined in the studio by Christian Parenti, who is featured in a movie called The Fixer, which will be shown at HBO starting this coming Monday. Welcome to Behind the News, Christian.
Thank you for having me back, Doug. It's not called The Fixer. It's called Fixer.
Fixer.
Fixer, The Taking of Ajmal Naqshbandi. And that's important because actually there are two other films, it turns out, called The Fixer.
So okay. Fixer.
Fixer, yeah.
It's like Messiah and Goethe Demeter, no definite article. So you're in elegant company there. So Fixer. Tell us about Ajmal. Who is he? How did you meet him?
Ajmal was a journalist, an Afghan journalist. He was from Kabul, and he was a fixer, which is to say he dealt with interpreting and for foreign journalists and logistics, arranging / fixing interviews, which is a very crucial role of how foreign reporting is done. Even if a foreign reporter speaks the language, one tends to work with a fixer of some sort, even if they're just the driver, someone who knows the kind of local ins and outs. I mean, even if you were fluent in Spanish and living in Colombia, you'd probably work with some version of a fixer, even if there was no need for interpreting. So Ajmal was 24. He ran a guest house with his brother for a while. And right after the invasion, my friend and colleague Teru Koyama, the photographer with whom I've worked on a couple of occasions, he did the photographs for my book from Iraq, he ran into Ajmal working at somebody else's guest house, and the guy was obviously brilliant and spoke perfect English that he'd taught himself by watching a couple of old VHS tapes inside during the Taliban regime. And Teru said, you know, you can make pretty good money working with journalists. So Ajmal became a very important fixer in Afghanistan. The film, and I worked with him over the course of several years when I was reporting.
How many trips did you make to Afghanistan?
Five trips. Each for about, like 6 weeks. So the story of the film is basically about what happened to Ajmal was he was kidnapped and murdered by the Taliban. And so the film is the story of what happened with Ajmal, how he was kidnapped, how the deal to get him free went bad. And it also tries and I think succeeds to be something larger than that as well, which is about explaining the kind of craziness that is Afghanistan and the dysfunctionality of the government, and explaining some of the history of the war.
The film emerged as something of an accident in that initially your friend and collaborator Ian Olds, who directed the movie, had taken some footage, and you as well, and Ian's original intention was to do a movie about how the news is made, right? The sort of, as you put it, exposing the labor process of journalism, and then it became a story much larger than that, right?
Yeah. What happened was that Ian, I met Ian in Iraq through a mutual friend of ours, Garrett Scott, and Ian and Garrett made a movie together called Occupation Dreamland, and then Garrett, which won the Independent Spirit Award, and then Garrett, a day before winning that award, died of a heart attack at age 38, and Ian and Garrett had already received a small startup grant to do a film about Afghanistan. And the three of us sort of, you know, worked together a little bit. I had dragged Garrett to Iraq the first time and helped them a little bit with that other film. And I was going to Afghanistan. That's, you know, we're sort of, you know, in contact about that. So that film didn't happen. And Ian was, like the rest of Garrett's friends, myself included, you know, very upset. And so to kind of get him back on the horse, I was like, why don't you just come to Afghanistan and just, you know, turn on your camera and see what happens since you have this grant to do that. So when he was there, he was thinking about maybe you do research for a feature, a narrative feature that he was writing about journalists, and maybe he would find a story along the way that had nothing to do with journalism, or maybe he would do a story about journalism, about the industry of journalism. And so shot some sort of exploratory footage of Ajmal and I working together, and as you mentioned, I had shot sort of essentially home video of working with Ajmal. And then we came back.
That was the footage at the beginning of the movie where you're interviewing the Taliban, right?
Yeah. And it was about a year later, or less than a year later, actually it was a year later when Ajmal was doing precisely the same thing, interviewing the Taliban, with an Italian journalist named Master Giacomo, that he and Master Giacomo were kidnapped, and eventually Master Giacomo was released and Ajmal was kept and killed, apparently on orders of the Pakistani intelligence through the kind of Quetta Shura of the Taliban.
Obviously this is speculative, but why would Pakistani intelligence want him killed?
The logic was that his case became an international cause celeb, and Karzai was looking really bad in the eyes of his people. Two Afghan journalist associations, were having hunger strikes in front of the National Palace. There were protests. People were really demanding that Karzai do something to get Ajmal back because he had been held 2 weeks longer than Master Giacomo. In reality, what happened was there was a deal cut originally that included Ajmal, and the Italian government paid money, and Karzai released 5 Taliban prisoners in exchange for the Italian journalists and for Ajmal. But nobody was paying attention to the details, and it turned out that one of the prisoners that the Taliban had requested in exchange was a high-level former spokesman and commander of sorts who had switched sides. He'd been captured in January, and this is happening in March of 2007. And in that time, he had started giving lots of information to the NATO forces and to Afghan intelligence and basically switched sides. So at the last minute, it became impossible to give them this prisoner. So they substituted a different prisoner, who was the little brother of the Taliban commander who was holding Ajmal and Master Giacomo. And it seems at the last minute, the Taliban decided to keep Ajmal back because they felt that the deal had been broken. Up to that point, everybody had been very quiet about this kidnapping, as is the way these things are handled. Your listeners will probably be aware of the fact that David Rhodes of the New York Times was held for 3 months without any news of this coming out, because the feeling is that if you put out a lot of news about kidnappings, that then you raise the value of the hostages. So this has been the logic that everyone was using. But once there seemed to be this double standard, then in both Italy and the United States, there developed this campaign to release Ajmal, and the Committee to Protect Journalists very valiantly got involved. And Ajmal had a lot of connections with journalists here in New York, people who worked for the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine. And we all sort of like mobilized and did whatever we could, which we've been holding back. And also partly because in Afghanistan, there was a grassroots campaign to demand that Karzai do something. And it seems that at the last minute, Karzai was prepared to make a new deal, but that the Taliban leadership and the ISI decided that it would be better for them, which is to say it would look worse for Karzai and the NATO occupation, if Ajmal was killed. And so a day before the deadline the Taliban had set for themselves, they decided to kill Ajmal. And it seems pretty clear that this was, a political calculation, that Karzai came off looking like a complete puppet, a tool of the American occupation.
Well, there's an amazing clip in the movie where he's saying, we had to release the Italian because the Italians built us a road, Afghans, tough, basically, right?
Yeah.
For a president of a country to say that foreigners are more valuable than the citizens is pretty bad news.
Yeah. So I think that's the reason why it happened. And I'm pretty sure that that's what happened. I mean, some of these details are not in the film because you can't do everything in a film, but I did an extensive article for Playboy about it and researched it really, really extensively, and I'm pretty sure that's what happened.
Yeah, this is certainly a little detour from the topic of the film, but what is Pakistan's aim in Afghanistan? What is it, the government as a whole? Is it a faction of the government? Is it a subset of the intelligence service? What are they doing and why?
I think that there's two things. I mean, Pakistan's main security concern is India. And so the military is concerned with facing off against India. Part of that strategy has been the idea that if India really invades, they're going to have to deal with guerrilla forces. So the Pakistani intelligence has always been sort of open to cultivating guerrilla elements, which they've also used in Afghanistan. Now, this most famously happened during the anti-Soviet jihad of the 1980s, during which the United States and Saudi Arabia funneled about $8 billion through Pakistan. Maybe it was $4 billion, I forget the actual number, but it was dollar for dollar, U.S. and Saudis, and the Pakistanis ran the Mujahideen, which was 7 parties of of fundamentalist guerrillas or mercenaries fighting the Afghan communists and the Soviets. And that's when a lot of links were built between these Afghan guerrillas and Pakistani intelligence. And partly it was about the Cold War and servicing their ally, the United States, and trying to weaken what was seen as a pro-Indian state on one side, Afghanistan. It's also about cultivating forces that if there was a land war with India would be a deterrent to Indian ground troops if they knew they would have to deal with, you know, guerrillas from Kashmir and other places. And then finally, a third kind of deeper issue is that the Durand Line, the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, was created in 1893 by a British diplomat named Mortimer Durand. And in that process, Afghanistan lost lots of land. And this might sound irrelevant to most Americans, but for Afghan elites, it's a big deal. And the ruling ethnic group in Afghanistan are the Pashtun, who are themselves very divided. But the ruling family has always been Pashtun. Karzai is Pashtun, and they're the people of the south. And it was their terrain that was cut in half. So you have Pashtun on both sides of the border. And in Pakistan, the Pashtun are kind of a restive, large minority. In Afghanistan, they're the dominant ethnic group. So Afghan irredentism was always about Pashtun nationalism. And likewise, the Pakistanis used Pashtuns in Afghanistan to undermine the state. And that this all begins in 1973. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is now a Taliban-allied terrorist fundamentalist warlord.
Most famous, I think, for throwing acid in the face of unveiled women, right?
Yeah, and largest recipient of U.S. aid via Pakistan during the anti-Soviet jihad. He actually gets his start after, you know, throwing acid in the faces of women at Kabul University. He resists the nationalist president of Afghanistan in the 1970s, is jailed, thrown out of the country, and the Pakistani ISI start arming him and sending him into Afghanistan to cause trouble. And at the same time, actually, and this is before the communist coup, before the Soviet intervention under President Daoud, President Daoud was also doing the same, arming Pashtun guerrillas to harass Pakistan. And this was part of Daoud's Pashtun nationalism, the idea that they did not accept what is now the border with Pakistan, that they felt that they had lost lots of land, including the city of Peshawar used to be Afghanistan's winter capital. So they wanted all that back. And many people in Kabul still do, you know, supposedly, you know, the Afghan elites who is supposedly don't drink, but of course do behind closed doors, you know, get kind of drunk, and they immediately start talking about, like, wanting to go back to Peshawar and taking this back from Pakistan. And so that's maybe a long-winded explanation as to what this enmity between Afghanistan and Pakistan is all about.
Speaking with Christian Parenti, who is a journalist, covered Iraq, Afghanistan, many other things, now working on a book about climate change and failed states and political instability, who is prominently featured in the film Fixer, No Definite Article, which will be appearing on HBO starting this Monday. And I saw it last night, and it's really first-rate stuff. So if you have access to HBO, please do check it out. I was talking to the director, Ian Olds, last night, and he said, complained that he's having trouble getting people to pay attention to Afghanistan. A lot of people don't want to pay attention to it, and people don't want to hear about it. But now we have the Obama administration as part of their movement of change, escalating the war in Afghanistan. What are they up to, and what are their prospects, do you think?
I think their prospects are pretty dismal. The security situation in Afghanistan has declined every year since the invasion of 2001. Kabul is now becoming like Baghdad. People are afraid of kidnapping and staying. Westerners are staying off the streets. And some recent kidnappings have happened, you know, right outside Kabul. I believe that David Rhodes was kidnapped not very far outside of Kabul, and there was an aid worker who was kidnapped in Kabul. So the situation is bleak. The fundamental problem is that the Afghan government is completely dysfunctional, totally corrupt, dominated by warlords. So it's incapable of doing anything. I mean, and so the heart of a nation-building counterinsurgency is that, you know, the local forces take over and these local institutions maintain law and order and have administrative capacity. And the Afghan state simply doesn't have that capacity. That's not the kind of thing it is. It's just a giant sort of conglomeration of family and clan-based organized crime networks that deal drugs and steal aid money and, you know, occasionally give people who need jobs.
And the president's brother himself is like one of the biggest poppy dealers in the country, right?
Yeah. Wali Karzai, who was the governor of Kandahar, is a huge drug dealer. There was just a big seizure on his land that he yesterday was trying to explain away. But I once had a British intelligence officer confirm this to me, and everybody knows this. And I asked, well, how do you know this? Thinking that he'd maybe, you know, be kind enough to whisper the existence of some secret report, which I'm sure they have. But he said, oh, how do you know? He said, well, when you drive across Wali Karzai's huge land holdings, you see that they're covered in opium poppy. You know, so that's one way. It's just like, because it's like right there next to the road, open production on the president's brother's farms are covered in drugs. So anyway, so that's Afghanistan. And so Obama, yeah, he's pouring troops into this, pouring soldiers. Why is he doing this? I think he's doing this not because he, you know, needs to maintain permanent bases there. Yes, they'd like that. They like having a base in Shindad, which is near Herat on the Iranian border. That's great to menace Iran. They like having bases near China and Russia. That's all great. I don't think they need to escalate the war to do that. They definitely don't want to lose those bases. They probably will. I think the primary thing is actually that Obama campaigned on essentially losing Iraq, right? And he did it by saying he was going to win Afghanistan. So it was good war versus bad war. And that was because he did not want to come across as a wimp. And I think the Democrat, one of the many pathologies at the heart of the Democratic Party is this fear of being called soft on crime or soft on, you know, imperialism. And so I think that the Obama administration, the people there, are smart enough to know that they're probably not going to achieve that much in Afghanistan, but that they figure to be reelected here in the United States in 3 years, they need to show that they really tried in Afghanistan, that they didn't just wimp out and cut and run. And so I think that's why all of this escalation is going on.
And the Taliban come off rather poorly in Fixer, don't they? They're pretty wretched force.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have much sympathy for them. I don't think we went out of our way to impugn them, but we just, you know, they killed our friend, and they're ideologically underdeveloped. They have no economic program. A little bit of land reform they did in the Swat Valley was, I think, you know, not just sort of tactical. It's not part of any kind of greater vision.
Who are they? And you know, it's not clear even what they want. But where do they draw their ranks from?
In Afghanistan?
Yeah.
They draw their ranks from the rural populations of the south, who are Pashtun, the poor rural populations of the south. They get, you know, their overhead is very, very low. I mean, their soldiers, like, you know, you hear this again and again, when they're found dead on the battlefield, they have, you know, nothing. You know, maybe like a blanket and a little piece of naan bread and an AK-47 and like a couple rounds. And they're paid very, very little. And, Mullah Omar is still alive and operating, it seems, out of Quetta. There are links to the Pakistani ISI. This is, debated back and forth, but I have not been convinced that the Pakistani intelligence services have stopped using those guys. I don't think there's any evidence that they have done that, and there's every piece of evidence that they continue to support the Taliban. So they have their rear guard in Pakistan, and they're a mercenary/guerrilla force that appeals to the tribal sensibilities of the Pashtun in the south, to Pashtun Wali, which is a tribal code of hospitality and honor and revenge. And there are foreign forces. I mean, it's quite simple, right? There are foreign forces with helicopters and trucks roaming the countryside, kicking in doors, searching the women's quarters. And this is in a society which is you know, this is not due to Islam. This is due to the tribal nature of the society there, which is extremely sexist. I mean, there's a type of gender apartheid in Afghanistan, in the south, particularly in the countryside, that doesn't exist in many other places in the world. So you go into a man's house and search his women's quarters and, like, see his wife and daughter and strip off their burqas. I mean, that's, like, an incredibly grave insult. So people are angry, and the Taliban appeals to them, gives them guns, maybe pays them $50 to strike back at these horrible invaders. These horrible invaders are, you know, routinely, by mistake, wasting civilians, and who all have relatives who are sworn to revenge. And so that's sort of what the Taliban is. I mean, it's this political force.
And now, of course, the invaders are jacking up the intensity of their invasion.
Yeah.
So is that going to be a good recruitment for the Taliban?
I would think that it is. You know, one of the weird contradictions in this whole thing is that, you know, a lot of people in the Obama administration say the right things. You know, they describe what should happen. You know, but I mean, I think they're kind of incapable of doing it. One, because they, you know, the Obama administration can't come up with the civilian forces it needs or the money. There's no there for the Afghan government. So it's just sort of like, you know, pouring money down a sink. You know, it doesn't hit the ground. It doesn't reach the people. The only asset in the U.S. toolbox that sort of works is the military one. And that one, of course, you know, has this blowback of infuriating the people and acting as a recruiting tool for the Taliban. So, yeah, I think that what should happen is something completely different, a total transformation of American foreign policy that would require a huge region-wide peace conference that would probably have to last, you know, a year or two, and that would involve everybody from Saudi Arabia, China, Russia, and would have to deal with all of the region's problems, everything from Pakistan and India's security issues to Palestine and Israel. Those issues are all linked. I mean, I was in Wardak province a couple of years ago, which is now under complete Taliban control, interviewing former Taliban. And they were talking about Palestine and Israel. They're like, why do you support Israel? Why does your government do this? Why do you, you know, it seems like you're just making war on Muslims everywhere in the world. So all these things are connected. Pakistan is not going to stop funding terrorism in Afghanistan and stop undermining Afghan security if it doesn't receive some sort of security guarantee from India. And if that sort of cold war with India isn't put to rest, there's no reason that Pakistan is going to stop doing that. I mean, Pakistan, as much as it's probably been sounding like I'm criticizing it, and it's the tradition of its state, which is, you know, has been very often a kind of a right-wing military state. I mean, they do have legitimate security concerns vis-a-vis India. They fought two wars and lost them both. So all of those kind of things have to be dealt with. Otherwise, I don't think, like, you know, 30,000 troops here, $2 million there, $1 billion here, X more diplomats there. No, that's going to work, I think.
Yeah, well, I think the prospects for that don't look very encouraging at the moment, though.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you for joining us, Christian Parenti. And again, Fixer, could you remind me of the subtitle?
The Taking of Ajmal Naqshbandi.
That will be appearing on HBO starting on Monday. And I saw it last night, and I think it's a terrific piece of work, and everyone should check it out.
And that was Christian Parenti. HBO will air the documentary Fixer starting on Monday, August 18th at 9 p.m. in the East, and at midnight, August 18th into the 19th, in the West. It will be repeated several times after that into late September. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Nerina Palo's anti-war pop song, Everyone's Gone to War, from 2003. Till next week, bye.